friends. Welcome to the Living Truth Podcast. This is Kristen Carey hosting today, and I'm very eager to bring this interview to you guys as our listeners with two amazing certified sex addiction therapists. I have with me Michelle Safier.
You got it.
And Alan Katz. You guys, Michelle is coming from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area, and Alan in the Memphis, Tennessee area. So they together offered a workbook called Ambushed by Betrayal. They both have extensive years and years of experience working with sexual addicts, people with problematic sexual behavior, also with betrayed partners, and both have a special interest in working with couples. In fact, Alan co-authored the book Help Her Heal with Carol Jurgensen Sheets about helping the person with the problematic sexual behavior develop empathy for their partner to help them heal. So these two bring so much knowledge and experience, and I know they're going to bring so much value to you as you hear today. So Alan and Michelle, thank you guys so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. So what was it that brought you guys to a place where you're like, we want to bring our work that's in with clients in a room, right? Our group work, our one-on-one work, our couples work, and we want to put it down on paper. I mean, you have so much experience with working with people that are struggling, and at the root of all of these issues that the people with the problematic sexual behavior have and the person who's been betrayed, what is the root issue that is happening for both populations?
So I hear two questions. Why did we do this?
Yeah.
And what's at the root?
Yep.
Yeah. And well, for myself, I really, on a practical level, I felt that working one-on-one with partners, you know, if I, not everyone gets the same information. It depends on what's happening in the session. So just in terms of how to get through their process and, you know, what they're facing and their journey. So putting it on paper, for me, having a book helps me to know all my clients are getting the same information. I'm not, you know, kind of missing a huge piece. And then I also, you know, wanted to extend the reach and help people who can't come to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a huge need. And it is such a complex process of recovery. How about you, Alan? What made you want to write this book to help partners?
Well, before I became a therapist at 58, I was in a marketing consultant, and I just loved to write, and it just very cathartic for me. And so when Michelle asked me to kind of help her with some of the marketing and the editing and writing, I jumped on it and just used, I think we originally were thinking like Michelle was going to work on the partner, and I was going to kind of give it a frame from the addict also. And so you'll notice in the book that a lot, you know, we'll have a thing called the why question, you know, why did you do this? And then we go in a little bit into the trauma of the addict, of what a lot of times goes on in their life as far as attachment and, you know, how they ended up becoming an addict, you know. And so, and then the rest of the book is, you know, about betrayal trauma and just Michelle's theories and specific model of how to deal with this and how to get better and how to eventually forgive and move on in your marriage.
One thing I loved is I didn't get a chance to read your whole workbook, but did get to skim the beginning of it, was all the grounding techniques that you are teaching people, all the different breath strategies, because in our groups, which primarily our organization focuses on groups for partners and groups for addicts. And in my groups for partners, we do grounding like in almost every single meeting we host, because it is such a need. Because back to that second part of my first question, which was what is at the root of the issues. So say, for example, for the partner, the root of what they're dealing with is complex trauma.
Right.
And so I'd love to hear more about the role of learning how to ground and why, for anybody with complex trauma, whether it's betrayal trauma or not, why that is absolutely essential.
So for me, the first, many of my the partners that I work with and have worked with urged me to, in the first chapter, to write, pause and breathe, just pause and breathe, because they're so overwhelmed and distressed that it's like they forget how to breathe. You know, they're holding their breath, right? So, so that was one piece of it. So we put grounding techniques in the beginning of the book and throughout, because in my experience with this particular type of betrayal trauma, because, you know, sexual abuse is, incest is betrayal trauma, yes. Right? It's not just about compulsive sexual behavior in marriage, but pardon me.
Okay, it's all right.
So with this type of trauma, first, in my experience, you know, we all have trauma. There's no escaping trauma. Most of the time we don't live with PTSD, with post-traumatic stress disorder, but for the kinds of traumas that Alan and I work with, which is the betrayal of someone, not just cheating or using pornography, but it's a betrayal to the core of the relationship, to the vows, to right, goes all the way down. And so for these folks, whereas in typical trauma, our brain suppresses the pain, as we know in internal family systems, that's the exile, the parts of us that are carrying the suffering in the unconscious. And then we adapt and, you know, figure out how to live. In my experience, not so with this particular trauma. Actually, it's the opposite, right? They can't stop thinking about it. The brain cannot put together the life that they've lived for many years. I work with couples that have been married a long time. And then this information and this reality they have. So they are obsessed and not their brain is obsessed with trying to make sense of what it is that's happening.
Right. They have to reorganize the entire narrative of their life. Reality collapse, right, is Michelle May's term, that's which right. I love. Reality collapse is very apt.
That's right. And you go, right, it's a reality. It's a today reality collapse. And then they start going back and, you know, over 30 years, there are thousands of moments and thousands of memories. And they kind of go, well, what about this time? What about this point? And it's the brain, you know, seizes them. This obsession seizes them. They lose their, yeah, the reality collapses. What is the past? They don't know. The future, everything is stolen from them.
Yeah. It's the brain is on fire with the trauma of it all. Yeah.
Right. It's as if their life is a whole lie, you know, for so many years. Yeah. That's what they feel like. Is this real or it's not real? Or, you know, I'm just confused, you know.
Absolutely.
Was anything real? Was anything ever real? Did you they just ever? That's why we went to the why question, because they cannot, forgiveness is so far off, but what was real when you, did you choose me?
Yeah.
Or was I just an acting out source?
Yeah. Yes, it is extremely disorienting. One of my dear friends who is a facilitator in our groups, she was doing gardening and found a little bone in her backyard. It was like a little vertebrae. And what flashed through her mind was, this was early after discovery, was, oh my gosh, my husband's been murdering women and burying their bodies in the backyard. And that is not true. But she did pick up the bone and looked at him and said, what is this? And he didn't know what she was talking about. That was when he realized that he knows his line that he would not have crossed. Like, he's not a murderer, But her brain could not make sense of who are you, because some of the things that he had done, she never thought he was capable of doing. And so when, for those of you listening who have problematic sexual behavior, and you wonder why your wife might be accusing you or your spouse, I'm using these gender pronouns, right. But I realize that it's just because I work with betrayed partners who are women, but you can change your pronouns as needed based on who did the betraying and whatnot. You know where your line is, but your spouse who you betrayed does not, they don't know who you are. So there's this total reality collapse. Okay. So here's what I want to ask you guys. I'm going to put you on the spot. Would one of you just do a very brief breathing or grounding technique, maybe your favorite one, because we're talking about this topic. And I know some of our listeners right now are starting to hold their breath, because what we're saying, either they've heard this type of information and it reminds them of how traumatizing this part of their story is, or they've never heard it before and they're flooding right now. So would you do our audience the honor of doing a grounding technique?
Alan, do you mind if I take that?
No, go ahead, Michelle.
So I'm trained in mindfulness-based stress reduction. So it just starts with turning inward, closing your eyes or averting your gaze, and noticing your breath. And noticing the breath as it comes in, and as it flows all the way down, bottom of the lungs, pushing out the diaphragm. And then noticing that exit breath as it comes up, it contracting the system and exiting and releasing all of the tension, all that's not needed. And then the breath in. And the breath in opens, oxygenates, awakens, and then that breath out releases, shuts down. The breath is coming in, noticing and releasing, and then expanding a bit. What else do you notice? Notice any sensations, any felt sense, your neck, tickles, anything at all. Just notice, attend, just we're noticing and attending to and not going with, right? There are thoughts that come in. We're noticing them as thoughts, and that's okay. We want our thoughts to be there. We want our feelings to be there, and we notice our breath and noticing the inward flow and the exhale and the stillness that we can carry amidst all of the interference in our head, that we can stay grounded in the eye of the storm just with our breath, just by the tuning into the breath, taking the breath in slowly through the nostrils and then releasing through the mouth. And the breath in, expanding awareness, expansion of self, expanding the system. And then always the release, the letting go, the exhale.
That's wonderful.
How was that?
Oh, it was so good. I needed that. I need it. Every time I lead my groups through grounding, breathing, I mean, even incorporating a grounding breathing technique through prayer in our close and opening of our meetings, I realize how much tension I'm holding just from the stress of life, not to mention for the people whose families have collapsed, right? On both sides, the trauma and the stress that we're carrying in our bodies is, it makes it impossible to focus, impossible to concentrate. So I hope for our listeners, you guys enjoyed following along with Michelle in that practice, and that it'll help you to become more present, to listen to the rest of what these amazing people have to share with us and teach us. So thank you so much. That was awesome. You guys were talking about the why questions, and some of your why questions I wrote down because I hear them on repeat. It's really interesting, isn't it? You probably have clients in your offices and you hear those same questions again and again. What is the spirit behind or the drive for having those why questions answered? And this is a two-part question. So that's one. What is the spirit behind wanting those why questions answered? And the other part of the question is, what are some of the most common why questions? I jotted down a couple that I read from you guys that I thought were really good. But can you guys answer those questions?
Alan, would you like to take that?
So what was the first, say the first one again?
What's the spirit behind all the whys? Like partners who have been betrayed tend to ask a lot of why questions. Like, oh my gosh, one of my favorite ones you guys wrote down was, why did he tell this other, the acting out partner, that he, I love you? Why? Oh my gosh. And your answer for why that is, I do want you to, if you remember what you wrote, and if not, I wrote it down here. But what is the spirit behind all the why questions? And for the people with the problematic sexual behavior to know, these are very normal questions and they're FAQs, frequently asked questions.
Right. Yeah, they're annoying to the addict because they don't want to answer them. But the idea behind this is that now I lost my train of thought.
It's okay. Do you want me to pause?
Yeah, just for a second. So for most addicts, what I tell my clients is they will say anything to keep the conversation going, okay? Whether it's sexual content, the whole point of the addict is the hunt. Just finding the person to talk to online or offline, or just to see if they still have it to be able to get that person or just, mm-hmm. Get that validation from somebody else. So they'll say, I love you to somebody because that's just what you say, but it doesn't really mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't love the wife or the partner. It just means that they're trying to continue that conversation with somebody so they keep it going.
And the reason why is so that they can reduce their inner turmoil, mm-hmm. right? That is really the reason why. Now, if you're the partner listening to this, you might think, cry me a river. Like, it reduce your inner turmoil. Do you know what kind of turmoil I'm in? See, I'm a partner. So I know and I work with partners. I know the thought. And so this may not be stuff that you can listen to right now. If you're not in a place of safety, stability, and where you've had the full truth laid out, you may not be in a place to have any potential desire to understand the why he is giving you the explanations that he is, that sometimes he doesn't even know the answer to the why question you're asking. So what Alan's saying about the reason why your husband, if he's not been in good recovery for a significant amount of time, he won't know the answer, the real true answer. The real answer is he's trying to medicate his pain because of his complex trauma. That's not an excuse. It's not an excuse for why he's doing what he's doing, but it is the real reason.
Right. I'm sorry, Michelle. I just tell you something funny. I do a group for men who have sexual addiction, and I've been doing it for like 3 years almost. And I went around one night and asked every single guy, why did you do this? Mm-hmm. And not one of them could give me an answer. I don't know.
How long had they been in recovery when you asked that?
Maybe 3 months to 6 months,
pretty early stages.
Pretty early stages, yes.
Have you since taught them why, Alan? Could they answer differently now?
I did a lot of research. Esther Perel has some ideas, and I wrote down a little fact sheet, like answering the why question, and I give it to them in group, and they're able to now they're able to identify, yes, I was trying to find myself. And that's one of the answers to the why question. I don't know who I am and I'm trying to find myself. Or sometimes it is that my wife's not giving me what I need. And so, you know, that's not an excuse either, but you know, you hear that. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but you do hear that sometimes.
That's part of how they justify their behavior.
That's the addict talking. But,
yeah. And I'd like to step in with how, with one of the pieces that I see with the why question. And, you know, just keeping in mind that the person in recovery from the addiction is a trauma survivor, because we know that trauma, and it's painful to think about because it feels like an off, like an excuse, like a get out of jail free card. But we need to live in reality to be healthy. And so they have a trauma story. It's usually neglect, right? We know that that neglect is the top reason why people turn to compulsive sexual behavior. And here's what I noticed. And I'm going to genderize it, with the men that I work with, they, and those that act out with other people, they are seeking mother's gaze. These are people that were neglected, right? They're seeking that, they are looking to see themselves reflected back from the eyes of the adoring mother, right? Because that's the original attachment, is that gaze. And so, you know, they'll do anything to get the gaze. I love you, the gaze. Of course, they pay people, because then they definitely give you what you need. But I just find that to be a particular piece that's hard to understand.
It's really important to know this for multiple reasons, but in my opinion, one of the most important reasons why we need to know that complex trauma is at the root of a sex addiction is because if all you do is try to stop the sexual acting out, and you never do trauma work, you never do your family of origin work, your parts work, to use the language of internal family systems, which is a therapy modality that I'm a huge fan of. If you never do that deeper work, you will not really become the vibrant, integrated person that you were created to be. You may stop sexually acting out, but you're probably going to switch addictions. You're probably going to start numbing out with shopping or drinking or working or religious activity or whatever it is, because there, and here's the other interesting thing. When I say, you're doing these things compulsively to numb the inner turmoil, a lot of partners are like, what inner turmoil? Like, I don't see any kind of an emotional reaction in him. But that's because he's been numbed out for so long. And some of the parts of that little boy that didn't get what he needed have gone into exile, right? And they're tampered down, like way deep down there. It's like completely frozen. And so he may not look like he has any inner turmoil. He may look like a pillar of emotional strength, but in reality, he's a scared little boy deep down in there. Again, not saying that as an excuse or to exploit your empathy if you're the partner and make you feel like, oh, I need to bend over backwards to like be there for him. Because I know one thing that's really painful for a lot of partners to hear is this fact that he has all this well of unmet needs, because I know many partners have bent over backwards to try to be the best wife they could be, to try to be there for their spouse, willing to love him. And yet, why was my love not enough? Like, why would he have to seek it elsewhere? So some of these partners, they're having sex with their spouse every day. They're available. All the traditional excuses and justifications the addict may give are not there. So how about that, you guys? What's the why question for why does he act out even if that wife is super present?
And, you know, Alan kind of hinted to it earlier. You know, one of the reasons that come up is because my wife didn't meet my needs. But if we look at this from someone who has not ever had their needs met growing up, then it's this preceded the partner. They do. They're beautiful partners. The people I work with are they love deeply. So they can't understand why. Is it my body? Is it? No, because they come, this person with the addiction comes into adulthood fractured, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's what, you know, different parts, they're acting in the world with, you know, not integrated. So for me, in my work, at least, I don't see that it's ever about what that partner doesn't do or doesn't have, you know, give enough sex or whatever their body looks like. It's, they are in many ways unable to attach in a healthy way to anyone, right, to themselves too.
Right. Yeah. And that's where a lot of this is not, it's not about sex, it's about power. And so that's another way that I have power. If I'm looking at pornography, for example, I can turn this video on and this video off. Or if I'm paying a prostitute, I can tell her what to do or what not, you know, whatever. But the problem is that the difference is intensity versus intimacy. And most people that have compulsive sexual behavior issues don't know how to be intimate with their partners.
Tell me more about that. What do you mean by intimate with their partners? Because the run-of-the-mill population out in the world thinks intimate means sex, but I know that's not what you mean. So they're looking for intensity, not intimacy, because they don't know what it is to be intimate. What do you mean by that?
Correct. So think about it. You know, I don't want to get too graphic here, but if somebody's looking at pornography and these people are having sex out for an hour or two, usually your, I don't know about y'all, but usually your partner is not going to be able to, you know, last for 2 or 3 hours, like somebody's watching something. So that's intimacy, that's intensity, right? Just over and over again, the same thing. Whereas then if your brain's screaming, then you're going to expect your partner or your wife to perform like that. It's not going to be, it's not intimacy. It's not, it's just part of your addiction again. So there's, I teach that there's 8 forms, 8 stages of intimacy.
Oh, and what are they?
I have it right here. Number one is attraction. Mm-hmm. Number one is attraction. Number 7 is sex. And so what happens is people go from 1 to 7, right away. I meet you, let's go home and have sex. Mm-hmm. And then they want to have a long-term relationship and they don't understand why they can't. And the reason is they're skipping 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are having common interests, being able to share things, just being able to have a conversation with somebody. Spiritual intimacy, morality, ethics, shared goals, hopes, fears, opinions, that's intellectual intimacy. Emotional intimacy is feelings and trust and security and safety. So for most wives, you know, safety, being, feeling safe enough to be in a relationship with a man is very important. And some guys will come home from work and they're having a really stressful day and they'll say, well, I want to have sex tonight because I'm feeling stressed out. So I want to have sex. So basically you're just using your wife. And to her, if you keep doing that, she doesn't feel safe. And so she's going to push you away. So you're messing up the whole relationship. So
yeah, and you're not spending the time on 2 through 6 again in your marriage, even in your marriage.
Right.
And I would say, so what's beautiful about the way Alan and I work together is I look at that trauma piece and Alan looks at the addiction piece, and there's just, it's sort of like, yeah, one is underneath the other. So it's a wonderful compliment. Mm-hmm. And on my side, I would say they never knew how to be intimate. You know, neglect, a neglected child is a child that is not seen, not valued, you know, not important. They don't matter. We all need to matter. And so here they grow up physically, but they are it's arrested development, I guess. They didn't have, right? They didn't have all of those ingredients, all those needs, all those people around them that taught them how to feel safe, how to be angry, how to ask for what you need, how to tolerate. And what I find is with some of the men I work with, it's like they can't tolerate that. For them, intimacy is a demand, not a request or a need. It's like a demand, and it feels engulfing, like they're losing their self.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I have to say, as an IFS therapist, that there are many parts of us, and we don't have just one size, fits all and one reason. And I can say, as a sex addiction therapist, what I've seen is there are these two, there's this split. So when the child doesn't get their needs met, either they go toward needy, towards seeking and neediness and dependency and trying to get their needs met that way, or avoidance, like it's unsafe. It's toxic. So either way, there's no sense of self. Mm-hmm. Because if the person that needs the other doesn't have a sense of self on their own, they need the other, whether it's the partner or, an affair partner. Mm-hmm. And the guys that have, so we would say those needy had distant and aloof mothering, because mm-hmm. it all goes back to the mother.
Yeah.
And those who had enmeshed or overbearing mothers, for them, intimacy is it's like taking the life out of them. It's taking, because that's what happened with mother, taking, mm-hmm. So they feel like intruded upon.
Wow.
Yeah. Either way, the folks are really high, like they really look good in the world. They look healthy, they work, they interact, they have friends.
They look like adults.
Right? They do. And so it's such a shock. Yeah. But I don't know, some partners, when we really get down to it, when they get past that first phase of shock and coping with the reality and sitting in the reality and beginning their own journey, because I really do feel like this is a hero's journey for partners. And it's not a victim's journey. It's a hero's journey. It's courageous. When they go into that, they can really see, did I ever really get what I needed? Did I ever really feel intimacy? Yeah, from their partner. Yeah. They'll say, I had a great marriage. At the kind of outset, like, I don't know what happened. But as they start doing their work, they realize they really accepted less than they deserved. And
sometimes we don't even know what is possible, especially if we start that relationship young.
Absolutely.
We don't know what alternatives exist. And I do think there's a lot of addicts that are really conflict avoidant. And so I've heard many partners say, well, we never fought before this all blew up, but it's because every time he had a need, he either met it himself because he didn't believe that she would be there for him, right? Because of his own injuries, or he held on to resentment for her not meeting the need and used it as fuel to act out.
Right.
But regardless, the never fighting thing to me, when a couple says that, I'm like, ooh, that's a yellow flag. Because two adults with different thoughts and feelings and desires are going to have conflict. It's normal and natural.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that why question, how can you possibly answer that?
Yeah.
Why? Because there's a lot of sickness, because there's a lot of emptiness, you know, that like hole in the soul. That.
And then there's also a lot of why questions that the addict tends to ask. So there's two sets of FAQs, right? We could probably like publish an FAQ document of for both populations. But some of these that I read in your Ambush by Betrayal are why can't you just forgive and forget?
Yeah.
I'm going to read them, and then I'd like your guys's feedback on where these questions are coming from, what's really behind the questions. Another one, why don't you notice how hard I'm working on my recovery? Yeah. Why aren't we having sex yet? Why can't you trust me already? I haven't acted out in months. And then one last question that's a when question is, when is it time for me to bring up my complaints about you? That's, oh my gosh. Yeah. So what's up with these whys in early recovery? Or some addicts are not in early recovery, but recovery hasn't really gotten them yet. And right. they're pushing back and objecting to her discomfort with these whys. So tell me more about where these come from.
So Michelle and I have had this discussion a lot about, when is enough enough? In other words, the wife or the partner is traumatized, right? And, you know, some people say, well, you know, it's going to take a year and a half for her to start trusting, okay? But, I mean, I have men 3 and 4 years of sobriety, and the wives are still asking the questions. And so, you know, when does the addict have that chance to say, well, you know, this bothers me about you? Not have to be about the sexual part, but just, but what happens is a lot is, you know, they feel they shut down, the addict shuts down and says, I don't deserve to have my needs met, because she's still upset and mad, and rightfully so. And so therefore, but when does there become a point where he is allowed? So that's that one question. But the other ones are just defense mechanisms, you know, of, you know, get over it already, you know, right. it's been 2 years, and it was just one time, you know, I just did it one time. What's the big deal, you know? And so get over it already. So, but that's the defense mechanism. They just want to brush it under the rug like they do every other feeling and every other thing that happens.
That's their denial. That's their avoidance. Yes. They want them to forgive. I hear that a lot. Why mm-hmm. can't you just forgive me? With regard to the partner that can't let go of their anger, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book as well. And why it's kind of why we looked at it from this hero's journey, because if they do not go down that path and deal with the hard stuff and, you know, fight their own internal monsters, then that anger becomes who they are. And it without help, without the right help, it's really important for your listeners to know that they must see someone who is a trauma specialist and a CSAT or a partner specialist, someone that's
trained clinician. Right. Yes, for right. sure.
Because this is not typical trauma. And once that anger gets wrapped around them, I feel like it wraps around their skeleton. It is like a cancer. And so it's understandable that there's a point where their addict spouse would say, when is it enough? It is, because it's become who they are in many ways, which is terribly sad, isn't it?
It is super unjust when the partner is like, I have to go into my own treatment. Are you kidding me? I didn't cause this problem. But I always say it's kind of like, Yeah, just like if you were in a drunk driving car accident and you weren't the one drinking and driving, but you were in the other car and you were a casualty of the other person's offense, you would still be responsible for getting your, you wouldn't be able to get yourself to the ER, right? You'd need an ambulance to take you there. And many of us, we need emergency level care in the beginning of our betrayal trauma journey. But then there comes a time where you're released and you have the choice. Are you going to go to physical therapy and learn to walk again or not?
Right.
And it absolutely sucks that you have to take your time away from your priorities and your busy life to go to PT and to do your exercises. Nobody wants to do that. It's terrible. But it's very painful. It's not fair. But it is our responsibility to deal with the wounds caused by somebody else's problem and take responsibility for who we become in light of that. One thing I think is so hopeful is that I watch partners do the post-traumatic growth thing so incredibly. I watch them emerge like a butterfly that's gone into the cocoon and like, you know, they, or a caterpillar, excuse me, go into the cocoon, turn into goo, right? And disintegrate. Everything disintegrates apparently inside that cocoon. And then emerge this incredible, beautiful creature that can fly. Like they can, they're higher and more beautiful than they ever were before. And I want to encourage you, dear listeners, if you're the partner, if you're the addict, that is entirely possible for you. In fact, we have kind of a butterfly in our logo for Living Truth for our organization, because the goal of all of this is not just to stop the acute pain for the partner, nor is it to restore the marriage. The goal is not for that addict to stop feeling so terrible and full of shame. The goal for all of us is transformation. And that is entirely possible with good help and hard work. And I love, Michelle, how you and Alan, how you guys talked about you've got to feel the fullness of the feelings in order to heal them, but using those grounding techniques along the way and titrating through the pain. And we can't do that alone either, right? We have got to have people around us to support us and love us and throw us that life preserver. We're not isolated beings. We must have community around us.
You know, you just brought up something really important. As a coming from a trauma therapist, from trauma science, a person that has suffered a life threatening, which this is trauma, and who then suffers from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You can't heal yourself because when the trauma happens, the person is fractured. Their thinking brain is not connected to their fight or flight and their fear. So you can't heal. But people kind of, you know, read books. Look, we've got a book, which are helpful. But there are particular, I really want your listeners to hear this. There are specific treatment modalities that they need in order to heal, like EMDR, you know, internal family systems work, brain spotting, body work. These are because the pain, the trauma is in the body, not in the head, right? We can't think our way or read books to heal ourselves.
No, it is a long and complex process, but it is definitely possible. We want to give you that hope. One other thing I wanted to touch on before we wrap up is a conversation we were having before I hit record that I thought was so important, is the tendency that we all have, whether it's as a partner or as an addict, to dehumanize one another. Yes. Can you talk more about that? Because when you boiled it down to its dehumanizing and why that's problematic in our recovery process, I was like, that is so important.
Okay. So I'll go ahead. So I was deeply moved by the work that Archbishop Desmond Tutu did where in the truth and reconciliation process in South Africa, you know, back with apartheid. And what he said was, if we see these people, the people that harmed us, as monsters, we're dehumanizing them, right? It's easy to hate monsters. When the Holocaust, the Germans saw, you know, they were kind of conditioned to see Jews as pigs. It's easy to kill a pig because it's not a human being. So he says, you know, we are all, under the right circumstances, we are all capable of the very same thing. We are all human beings capable of sinking into that kind of darkness, given the situation. So humanizing people, dehumanizing is, well, first, it's not healing. It doesn't heal the pain.
No, if you think about what is the root of racism, genocide, all kinds of horrors are rooted in the dehumanizing of either a category of people because of their color of their skin, their, you know, race, religion, etc. And it's extremely damaging to dehumanize other people.
And what about the richness of a person? You know, a person isn't just that, the behavior, although it's terribly painful for both. But what about all the other aspects of self, the beautiful parts? We are all a compilation of many parts of us. And so to boil someone down, right, to a monster or whatever is neither person heals, right?
No. And this is really important and interesting, because saying to a partner, like, let's not dehumanize the addict. I say that with so much love and care, because just because we urge you not to dehumanize does not mean that you shouldn't have good boundaries or that you should be in a relationship with them. I mean, there are some people that are incapable of rigorous honesty, or they're incapable of fidelity. You know, they won't do their hard work. And you need to part ways. You need to end the relationship. And that's not the outcome we want. But I'd rather do that and have good boundaries and then look at that person with dignity and respect.
Exactly.
Because then I am who I want to be. You know, I am full of love and full of respect and full of care for myself and for others. That is so important. I think most of us really want to be that kind of person.
Yes. And, you know, the pain is so horrific that on the one hand, we can understand, and it makes perfect sense that it's so offensive and just on so many levels that I couldn't even, you know, honor right now. Right. And still, they're your partner. It's the person you lied next to. And still, so there's a part of them. That's where that parts work. There is a part of them that does horrible, horrible things. It's extreme things that people don't typically do. Mm-hmm. But that's a part of them. What about all the other? But we have to have the balance.
We do. And we have to look at where the partner is at developmentally. So just like a child, I would never expect my 3-month-old baby to be potty trained.
Right.
Right? I mean, I would not expect a partner 3 months, 6 months from D-Day, like, I would not say to her, let's work on humanizing your husband. Like, that's just not developmentally appropriate. So this conversation, if you hate what we just said about don't dehumanize your spouse, maybe it's because it's something you really need to look at, because you've been far enough in and you're getting in a habit of dehumanizing. Or perhaps it's because you're not developmentally, so to speak, ready, because you're not in the right phase of your recovery to focus on that. In which case, I hope you're not listening anymore and you can just move on, or let it go. Take what you like and leave the rest, right?
Right, right. But isn't that the purpose here of this work that you're doing? To really help people to come to their own reality. We have to face reality at all costs here.
Yes. Oh yeah. You guys had a quote in your book about the commitment to staying in reality. What was that?
Mental health. That's from that's Scott Peck.
Okay. What is it?
Mental health requires us to remain, to be in reality at all costs, at all costs. We have to face it.
Yeah. And that is painful, hard work.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Well, thank you
guys. That's the way out.
It is the way out. Thank you guys so much. Is there any last words you'd like to say to our listeners to help bring them closure or value in the things that you have brought to us today?
For me, I hold deep respect for people who have not only lived through this, who seek help, deep respect. And my heart is with, it's a terrible, terrible, terrible trauma to live through. And it's courageous for them to, for partners to come in to listen to your podcast. And I would say on the other side, it's deeply courageous to face your worst behaviors, right? For the person with the addiction, it's to look in the mirror and face, what have I done to my partner? What have I done to myself? What have I done to my children? So much respect, much respect.
Thank you, Michelle. Alan, any last words?
Well, I would agree. I agree with Michelle, obviously. And I would just say that it does take, the studies show that if both people are in some type of recovery process or in therapy, that both partners, that there's a 90% chance that the marriage can be saved. And so there's a lot of hope out there. And at the beginning of this process, right after D-Day, neither one of you has much hope, but I'm just telling you from experience that we both have, that there's so many new resources now for partners and for addicts, and so many places to go and experience trauma healing and resources, reading material, workbooks, all kinds of things that are out there. And so I just encourage everyone to take advantage of some of those things, and you'll reap the rewards in the future.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, both of you, for being here with us. And dear listener, do what you need to take care of yourself. This is a lot of great information. I hope it's been helpful to you. If you're enjoying listening to the Living Truth podcast, would you take a moment to rate or write a review, make a comment? All of that helps more people find our podcast and get the hope, the help, and the healing that they need to recover from sexual addiction, unwanted sexual behavior, and sexual betrayal. And until the next episode, I am holding out hope for you.